Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This episode of Desert Island Dishes is brought to you in partnership with Kilinco. Kilinco is a homeware company all the way from sunny Burma. They work with small family workshops all over the country to make gorgeous things for your home and are the perfect place for you to find something a little bit different, seriously special, and wonderfully warming for your loved ones this Christmas. Kilinco works directly with the people who make their products, and every time you buy something from them, they reorder a replacement from the makers straight away. This keeps money flowing into the pockets that really need it and talented people in skilled work. So head over to Kilinco.com to choose from gorgeous rattan trays, bowls, even ice buckets, exquisite lacquer bowls, unique hand-blown tumblers and vases made from recycled glass, mother-of-pearl jam spoons to make the simplest breakfast feel special, hand-woven cushions and textiles. I mean, there really is something for everyone, even for batty aunts and awkward in-laws, and each order comes with a bonus helping of the feel-good factor. To make it even snugglier, they've given you a 15% discount code to get you going. It's Desert Island Dishes, all one word, and the website is kilinco.com. That's K-A-L-I-N-K-O. Thank you, Kilinco. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island Dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. I hope you're all well. It feels so nice to be back, and I just wanted to say a huge thank you to everyone that's messaged me since I've been gone. Honestly, it means the world to me that people enjoy listening to this, and I'm excited to be back asking my favorite questions. The world has changed a lot since I was last here, so it goes without saying that I hope you're all okay. This is my first episode recorded remotely, so please bear with me as practice, I'm hoping, very much makes perfect. We have some brilliant guests lined up, so without further ado, I know you've waited over a year for this, so here is today's episode. My guest today is Dawn O'Porter. Dawn is an author, broadcaster, writer, podcaster, and journalist. Having trained at drama school, Dawn became a TV presenter, rising to fame with her critically acclaimed BBC documentary, Super Slim Me. Many more TV shows followed, and in 2013, Dawn began a new chapter of her career. She released her first novel, which got shortlisted for the Waterstones Children's Book Prize. More books followed. She's now written 7, and she's continued to have huge writing success as a Sunday Times bestseller. Dawn lives in Los Angeles with her movie star husband, 2 young sons, and her dog, Potato. Dawn has said, "I love food. I realize that's a basic statement and might not sound like it warrants a whole load of page time, but for me, it does. Food is a great passion and pleasure of my life. Reading cookbooks, shopping for ingredients, spending hours in the kitchen, making it, serving it, and then eating it. Brilliant." Welcome, Dawn.
Thank you.
It's honestly such a pleasure to have you on Desert Island Dishes. Your podcast was one of the ones that I first listened to and I think encouraged me to start my own.
Oh, great. Well, that's so nice. I love the idea of the show. I'm so jealous of it. It's one of the, you know, sometimes when, because there's so many podcasts and then sometimes you hear about one, you're like, I wish that was mine. I wish that I just picked food and just got to talk about food.
Well, yeah, it's kind of the dream, isn't it? There were loads of different quotes that I could have picked, obviously brilliant things that you've said over the years, but one particular one that did stand out was, if I'm going to go down, I want to do it slathered in mayonnaise and eating kettle chips.
Yes, that's it. I want that to be my beautiful demise.
I think maybe that should be your sort of epitaph, maybe, or maybe a tattoo.
I died covered in mayonnaise.
I mean, that just sounds completely delicious, doesn't it? So my first question for you is, how do you think you'd get on the desert island? Are you good in your own company?
I love my own company. There's, which is why lockdown has been hard for me, because I've never been alone. Kids. So I think part of being a writer is needing to be alone and enjoy being alone and not go crazy. And when you do start to go crazy, you use that craziness and put it into your work. And it's only, as far as I'm concerned, a bonus is being alone. So the idea of being on a desert island, as long as I had some sort of writing utensil, sounds completely dreamy to me, especially after lockdown.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say lockdown's been kind of stressful because you haven't been able to socialize with lots of different people or whatever. But yeah, you basically couldn't escape your children. You haven't been alone this whole year.
No, I mean, they started to go back to school now. So I'm getting those kind of moments, those days, that kind of 9 to 3 alone time again, which is absolutely heaven. But even still, right now, the idea of going on a desert island alone, which is ridiculous after this year, it just sounds like a dream.
Go on, we can arrange it.
Do send me there. Just make sure. I just need like a face shield and a mask and some like gloves and loads of hand sanitizer to get there. And then when I get there, I can shed all that stuff and just relax.
Well, yeah, that's true. Okay. I'll get cracking on it. So I feel like there's a lot to talk about, but let's dive straight into the first desert island dish. And that is the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
I find this question really hard, as I'm sure lots of people do, because there are so many. And if it's all right with you, I'm going to pick two and I'll get through them quite quickly.
That's absolutely fine.
Because they both represent really different times in my life. So until I was 10, I lived with my grandparents and they lived in quite an straight up, straight down, not particularly creative townhouse. And the food that we ate wasn't particularly creative either. It was a real kind of ham, egg and chips type childhood, which is not a complaint. But the one dish that really reminds me of the 80s and being like pre-10 is chicken and white wine sauce in a tin that I used to eat with a bag of Uncle Ben's boiled rice in a bowl, leathered with salt on the floor next to the heater in the kitchen. And I used to sit on the floor with this bowl of like salty, creamy chicken out of tin, which I wouldn't go near now, but just the taste of it was just my favorite thing. And that I can taste it now and I love it. And I try to now make the same dish with like chicken that hasn't been in a tin for 6 months because the idea of it just went really terrible now. But that really reminds me, I was had quite a sad childhood. Those years were quite sad because I lost my mom, and I remember just finding like so much comfort in that bowl of food. And then my next one, when I was 10, I moved in with my aunt and uncle into this kind of wonderful country cottage where my auntie was this fantastic cook. And suddenly my relationship with food just changed forever because, you know, she was cooking sole for dinner and shucking oysters and getting winkles from the beach and coming home and boiling them. And we just had our palate just got expanded. But suddenly the Sunday roast became this just symbol of change. It was cooked to perfection, like not soggy, mushy vegetables, which had been my grandparents' preference. And that's, again, not a complaint. I loved it at the time. I just suddenly got introduced to new things and just, you know, very kind of not tough meat. And a gathering of like 6 to 8 people every Sunday where we would just have this feast that my auntie would prepare. And I remember this kind of feeling of being emotionally lifted by this Sunday experience. So those would be my two big childhood meals.
What was her speciality on a Sunday?
I mean, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. She would always do a huge Yorkshire pudding, not little small ones. So it was kind of this massive sheet of Yorkshire pudding that would just blow up in the oven. It was absolutely amazing. And then just kind of cut it into slices. Oh, God, I mean, just...
That sounds amazing. I mean, she sounds like an amazing cook. I think I read that she was sort of serving you avocado mousse for starters and having 3-course meals every meal.
Yes. And she would do it wasn't that it was posh. It was more just, she was just a massive foodie. She was really into ingredients and really into recipes and following recipes. And my gran just wasn't that kind of cook. So it was just a huge palate change. But there would always be a salad in a side dish. And there would always be maybe a starter of like melon and ham or something like that. Just like a spread every night. It's so good.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, really amazing.
Do you think that your obvious love of food now would always have appeared? Or do you think it was something that was kind of nurtured from that time that you had with your aunt and uncle?
I think having that huge culinary cultural shift at that age meant that I suddenly had this opportunity to see food very differently, which meant that I was very excited by it. And I think because of that, because we lived in Guernsey, we used to go to France a lot for the weekends with my aunt and uncle. So we would have a lot of French food where we'd be very adventurous. There's kind of this old family story that my uncle likes to tell where when I was I would have been under 10, sitting in a restaurant, the waiter asked what I wanted and I asked for 6 oysters to start and then 24 oysters for my main course. And apparently the restaurant just kind of like stopped. What did that child say? So I was always really adventurous. And I think that, who knows if I would have always been the same, but I think they opened a door for me to eat the kind of food that was exciting. And so I think it gave me a relationship with food that was emotional and about adventure from quite an early age, which I'm very grateful for.
Amazing. And also I think, well, about that oyster story, I think I read that love for oysters was slightly short-lived.
Oh, my God.
Not to lower the tone, but...
No. I'm going to go into details. Why the hell not? So listen to me. Anyone out there who's experienced food poisoning at the hand of an oyster will know how close to death you come.
Yeah, I have to say, Dawn, I've been there and it's bad.
It's awful. I was opening the Southampton boat show for some weird reason. And they invited me after I'd cut the ribbon. They invited me to the oyster tent where I got oysters and a glass of champagne. Let's just say I didn't leave Southampton for 2 days. I found the last hotel room in the whole of Southampton and almost died. And then 6 weeks later, but I do remember we'd been really excited to go to this new restaurant. Say I got sick on the Tuesday. We were excited to go to this new restaurant on the Friday that we had a booking for. And I made it back up to London on the Friday and I felt so guilty. I couldn't eat anything, but I was so skinny. I wore an actual catsuit.
Well, there's always a silver lining.
I was like parading around in this catsuit, but I couldn't eat anything. And then 6 weeks later, I went to a restaurant and just determined that this wasn't going to be a thing. I ordered cooked oysters and got as sick again 6 weeks later, because apparently once you've had the oyster thing, it doesn't leave you. And I thought...
They remember.
There's what that oyster is still inside of me waiting.
Okay, let's move on. Sorry that I brought that up. But
I'm happy to talk about it anytime.
It's very generous of you, Dawn. I always wonder with that question, as a mother yourself, what do you think your sons would answer to that question if they were to look back on their childhood? What do you think the dish will be that most reminds them of their childhood?
I mean, shamefully, because of lockdown, probably hot dogs right now. I cook relentlessly. I cook separately for the kids and separately for us. So as in, I cook for them at 5 and I cook for us later. My youngest Valentine is annoying. But Art is now, he's nearly 6 and got to the age where he'd try anything. But I kind of established at the start of lockdown that every Saturday lunchtime we have hot dogs.
Oh, that's such a nice tradition.
It's quite sweet. And I think they'll really remember it because I do cook. Like neither of them really love pasta. So I can't even do like pasta 3 nights a week. So I have to do things all the time. I make lots of sausage rolls for them. They love sausages. That's always a hit. But I do think that the kind of excitement of the Saturday hot dog has become a bit of a thing. And also I do a Friday bowl. So after dinner on a Friday, they watch TV with like a bowl of a few gummies and crisps and treats. And because I'm a bit of a bitch about sugar with the kids, not really actually for health reasons, just because it makes them crazy and I can't deal with it. So I'm quite strict about sugar, which means when they get it, they're so excited. And so after dinner on a Friday night, they get gummies and things. They might remember their Friday bowl.
Yeah, I think it's so nice to do things like that. Obviously feeding them is nice, but I think to do things sort of specific like that.
They respond well to that.
Things that they will look back and remember. I think that's really nice. And sort of the kind of thing you actually have to make a conscious effort to try to create those memories, I think, almost.
I think you do. I mean, Chris laughs at me a lot because I'm obsessed with traditions, not traditions that exist as in traditions that we're supposed to take on from the world, but creating our own. I think because my mum died, I've got this very kind of romantic idea of I want them to say on Fridays we had the Friday bowl, on Saturdays we had hot dog, on Sundays we went for a walk. Like that, I want them to have like my Sunday lunch tradition that I did with that my auntie did. It's something that I refer back to that I do now that is really important to me. It's a focus point of my memory of being a childhood that's centered around food and people. And I do actively try and do that with the kids of like try and create things that they'll remember.
I think that's really nice. That's really nice. Okay. Let's move on to the second desert island dish. Dawn, what was the first dish you learned to cook?
Oh, gosh. I mean, first dish I learned to cook, I think it was probably my auntie's spaghetti bolognese. She really kind of threw a spin on spaghetti bolognese. She used to really go to town on it. Mushrooms, lots of tomato, bubbling away for hours. And it was covered in Parmesan and just really loads of garlic, really, really delicious. And so when I went to university, I would try and recreate it, but it never tasted the same. And the reason it never tasted the same is because I used to buy terrible ingredients because that was all I could afford, and which is fine. That's how it should be when you're a student, but it never tasted as good. But I used to really, really, really try with it. And I used to cook it a lot because it was a really, I lived with six boys at university and it was a really satisfying big pot thing that I could cook for everybody. And so that was it. And then over the years, I've kind of, you know, perfected it. My recent discovery that tins of tomato sauce is so much more delicious than tins of tomatoes.
Ooh, what, like a passata?
Yes, that's it. They call it just tomato sauce here, but yes, passata, exactly. The flavour that you get from it is so gorgeous. Just, and so I've been using that with good quality minced beef now, and the trick with the bolognese is to, you know, put the wine in at the right point and just let it cook for hours so the meat goes buttery and isn't kind of grainy. And that's when I think about me cooking it at university and that kind of very cheap mince that I, the thing I didn't know is how long you had to cook it for. And I just remember this kind of grainy meat taste. And actually that meat is fine if you cook it for a long time, but I didn't know that at the time. And the best thing that I ever learned, but that I never really learned from my auntie until later, which is why my cooking at university was so bad and the bolognese never tasted good, is that when you cook with tinned tomatoes, people think you just have to heat them up. You have to cook them for ages to turn them sweet. And at uni, I used to buy, so the kind of cheaper meat that I didn't cook long enough, so that was grainy, and then just pour in tomatoes and heat it up and think that was cooked, and then serve it saying, oh, this is my auntie's famous bolognese, and all my housemates would be like, it's disgusting. And I couldn't understand.
Your poor aunt.
I know, but I couldn't understand why it was so bad, because all of the ingredients were right. I just, the cooking time was all wrong. Once I discovered, like, you know, let it sit for 2 hours, then it would have been delicious, but unfortunately my housemates didn't experience that.
Yeah, but it is one of those things that you're right, because technically after 20 minutes, you know, it is ready and it is edible. But as you say, it just gets better and better the longer you cook it. Yeah, I want to pick up on the fact that you lived with six boys at uni.
I did, yeah. And then when I first moved, oh, hang on, at uni there was 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. And then at uni, I think, when I moved down to London, there were six of us. We all lived in a huge warehouse conversion. And all my friends were boys at that time in my life. And I mean, it was great. We used to, when we were at uni, we used to split the shopping and all go to the supermarket together and chip in like $20 and buy loads of food and each take a night and cook.
Oh, that's so fun.
It was, but I mean, our diet was awful. It was white bread, crisps, like white rice, white pasta. I developed the worst gluten intolerance when I was at university, because it's just...
And scurvy, maybe?
Yeah, and scurvy. It was so unhealthy, and just drank like pints of beer for a pound, like go out and drink seven of them in one sitting. Like we were all so bloated, but it's really fun.
Yeah. You only live once.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I read in your latest book, Life in Pieces, that you sort of knew age 10 that you wanted to write. How was it that you ended up going to drama school?
Because I think I just got the message confused in my brain that I wanted to be, I loved performing and I was kind of good at it, but I was, something happened in the actual bit. When I was on stage, I was fine, but I just, the rehearsal bit always really threw me. I was like, I didn't really enjoy it. I wasn't like, rehab, I don't know, but I still convinced myself it's what I wanted to do. So I went to drama school, and really quickly when I got there, I realised that acting just wasn't what I wanted to do at all. I always thought that I wanted to do musical theatre. I always wanted to do that thing. And then I'd actually get up and just think, oh, I just don't love it like I thought I did. And so I started to kind of do radio stuff at college. And then instead of in my third year, instead of doing a play, I asked if I could produce a TV show instead. And then I went down to London and did a work placement on Bedil and Skinner Unplanned as a runner instead of doing a play, and just realised that I didn't want to be an actress at all, which It's quite frustrating to learn after 3 years of drama school, but...
It is, but then life is also about finding out what you don't want to do, because that gets you closer to finding out what you do want to do, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. And then I moved down to London and I really wanted to be a TV presenter. That was all I wanted to do. So I started working in TV and then eventually kind of started to move in front of the camera. And that was all great. And I really enjoyed all the old documentaries that I did and everything. But I always on the side wanted to write. I always wanted to write and knew it was there. But writing is... It's tricky. Weirdly, you need a lot more confidence to write than to be on camera. To pass over what you've written was terrifying.
I feel like maybe writing's a bit more exposing, because if you're presenting, you can kind of be a character. Whereas with the written word, people are kind of, I don't know, it's easier for people to judge the real you, maybe.
Yes, but also it's... when you're doing any sort of production, whether it's acting on stage, on TV or film or presenting something, you're part of a huge team. Like, you're not out there on your own. With writing, when you read one of my books, until the moment it's finished, it's really just me and my editor who has had anything to do with it at all. It's the most... And sometimes she doesn't even get to see anything until I've finished, because I hold it all back.
Really?
Yeah, it's entirely me. And then someone comes in and makes sure that it all makes sense and corrects your spelling, and then it's turned into a book. And then suddenly it's out there. Like, that is...
Yeah, that's really scary.
Terrifying. You can't blame anyone else. But there are a few old TV shows that I made that I didn't like the edit of. And I could always say, I think the editor fucked that up. But with my writing, I could never say that anyone did anything. It's all me. And so that's a scary thing to start doing. I found that intimidating. And I think the reason why I knew I wanted to do it is because how much I cared about how good I wanted it to be.
And I think maybe it's good to be a bit scared of something, because it means you really care. Probably leads to a better result anyway, doesn't it?
I think so. And also, writing was just always really loyal to me. Like, TV industry, I did really well. I was really successful in my 20s. And then when I turned 30, I had no work. It was all awful. I'd been totally ditched. I couldn't get a TV show for love nor money. I just didn't know what to do. But I had a column and I was writing, and then suddenly a book deal came out of that column, and I kind of looked at it and I thought, oh, if I keep writing, I will always work. I'm not relying on this huge industry that sees me as disposable, which is how I see TV. And if I just keep writing, I will always have an income. And so that realization just made me completely focus in on it and just ditch all the TV stuff, which is the best thing ever.
That's so interesting. Okay, I want to ask you more about that, but let's just pause and talk about the third desert island dish. And that is the best dish you've ever eaten.
Wow. Oh gosh, so many come to mind. That's really hard.
That's a really hard one.
I mean, there's so many different categories of where this question could fall. The dish that I think about so often, and I've been lucky enough to go to some amazing restaurants and eat some fantastic things, but the dish that I crave, I think about all the time. Chris and I were on our honeymoon where we had some amazing, amazing food. We started off in Vegas where we had fantastic steak. Then we went to Florida where we had lovely things, and then we went to St. Lucia where it was all awesome, and then we ended up in New Orleans, and we went to the French market in New Orleans. Now, Chris doesn't eat fish, so generally if there's a fish extravaganza happening, I'm on my own. And what it means is, even though I do eat fish, I don't, because if the truth is, I prefer meat. So if we're sitting in a restaurant and he orders a whopping great T-bone steak and I've got a little like slither of Dover sole, I'm just so jealous and upset, so I end up eating way more meat than I would if I married someone who ate fish. Anyway, we went into the French market. We had two things. First was a moufflata sandwich, which is a New Orleans sandwich. And it's the specific three types of cheese with this like olive tapenade. And it's just one of the most fantastic sandwiches. People try and copy it around the world. I've had it here in Los Angeles and it's never the same. The way they do it in New Orleans is kind of spicy and bitter, but cheesy and just fantastic.
Dawn, you had me at three cheese. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. So if you ever get the chance to go to New Orleans, you had to have the moufflata. And then tickle on through the French market and you come across this stall with these enormous vats of smoking crawfish in this absolutely incredible infused, like whatever you call it, whatever they're cooking it in, like the spices and the broth. And they just like scoop out a pint of crawfish, shove it in a bucket and give it to you. And My husband just sat and watched me eat bucket after bucket of these crawfish. And I was like, this is hands down, it's garlicky and spicy and just the most aromatic, flavoursome, fantastic. Oh my God. And I just sat and ate them and I ate them and I ate them. And I have thought about them almost daily since I was there. And what was that? Probably 8 years ago. So when you ask me that question, that's the dish, that's the meal, that's the thing that I think about the most and how I can't wait to go back to New Orleans and go and get them.
Oh, that sounds amazing. And also so nice that those are both from your honeymoon.
I know. How romantic. I also ate, what's the mock turtle or turtle soup in New Orleans, which I would not recommend. No need.
So what you said previously about your career, it really made me think, because from the outside, you were definitely very successful. And I wondered if having such a successful career in TV put any kind of pressure on you for what you would do next, and sort of when you started writing, having experienced the sort of highs and lows, did it make you nervous about doing the next thing?
Weirdly, if I went back into TV again, I would never see it as my career almost. I feel like it would always feel like something I stepped in and out of. But with writing, I don't, because I don't trust it. And, you know, there's been amazing TV shows on that people have loved that just get cancelled. Like, no one, you're just at the mercy of big decisions made by somebody else. So weirdly, I don't, in terms of nervousness, I have so much confidence with writing, because like I said before, as long as I keep doing it, I will always work, whether it's a blog or whether it's a book or whether it's a whatever it is, as long as I keep producing. And also, I think the thing is with writing, I actually did a blog about this the other day, because people ask me all the time, like, how can I become a writer, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, you have to treat it like a skill that you need to hone. Like, part of the skill of writing is actually having the motivation to sit at your computer from 9 to 5 and write. And that's the, honestly, someone said to me years ago, this TV producer, and I said to him, I'd like to be a writer, but I don't know how. And he just said, sit at your computer and write. That's the hardest part. And I think now we've kind of nailed that. And the kids have actually weirdly helped, because when I have childcare or they're at school, I have to use those hours to work. When before I had kids, I would just have this expanse of time, 24/7 weekends, and I did way less because I didn't have a working day. And so now I feel really confident about it, because, you know, I'm just in a position where my work is doing well. And if I get nervous about, you know, when they say things like, you're only as good as your last book or whatever it is they're referring to, you're only as good as your last meal, you're only as good as your last.
Ah, so many of these sayings are so stressful.
They are stressful, but also it's important. It's my job. It's important for me to, you know, if I was going to an office every day and I had a boss, I'd need to keep my standard up and I need to keep working to, you know, keep achieving at work. And you have to have that same attitude when you're creative. You have to think, how can I make this more interesting than what I did last time? How can I, you know, keep making my work exciting for my readers who spend money on my work? How, like, they're going to go out and buy my book. How can I, I've got to make sure that's a good experience for them, that they're not disappointed at the end of it. And that's motivating. It's not stressful for me. It's motivating, and it's how it should be, I think, especially when you're in such a like me, where you're asking people to financially support your work and pay for it.
Yeah, of course.
So, but I like that exchange, and I feel like it's a fair exchange. You pay for my book, and I'll do my absolute best to make it brilliant for you.
Yeah, that's such a nice way of thinking about it. I hadn't considered it like that before.
Yeah, and with TV, there's so many people who interfere with the job that I would do. That's when I start to lose confidence. Like, well, who's going to direct this? Who's going to edit this? Who's going to make it different from what I've done?
Something else that you said was, when you were younger, you craved fame, but you come to realize that it isn't actually fame that you want, it's success. And I thought that was really interesting, because so often those two things are conflated, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's when you realize that they're two very different things, it's a real relief. And fame is quite fun. I have a tiny bit of it, which I really enjoy. I really enjoy when I could tap into it and get response from it. Like, for example, my Instagram account is, you know, me showing off entirely. I like it when I'm able to sell my work because I have a profile. That's all really wonderful. And I guess that's kind of part of fame. But I have quite a famous husband, and I never thought that I would be in a position where I'm glad that that's him and not me.
Oh, that's so interesting. Is that how you feel?
Well, yeah, because I kind of get the benefits of it, but without having to actually be it.
Have you ever been with him sort of out and about and someone asks you to take a photo of him and them?
Oh my God, that happens all the time.
Oh, it does?
Yes, and I used to get really annoyed about it. But see, when we first got together and I was very insecure about work, like I said before, when I just lost all my TV work and he had just done Bridesmaids. And so I was literally failing as my husband was conquering the globe. And it was weird because it's not a jealousy thing because I don't want to do his job and he doesn't want, like, you know, it wasn't that. It was just a really highlighted how badly I was doing. And also I was kind of thrust into the spotlight, never been on red carpets before, never done anything like that before. And I just felt really, really unimpressive in myself. And I was suddenly surrounded by all these people who were like, I thought was so impressive. And they'd go, what do you do? And I'd be like, nothing.
Oh no, not. And it wasn't nothing, but that's just how you felt.
Oh God, that's just how I felt at the time. And I never had the confidence to go, I used to make these amazing documentaries and I'm just going through a stage where no one's buying them. But, you know, but I have still done great things. Didn't say that. I would just be like, yeah, nothing. And so I used to get really upset when I just was basically the camera woman for all of Chris's fans. And then I'd just kind of skulk on.
Hold my bag.
Yeah, literally. And now, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, now I don't care. The funny thing is I don't want to be in the photo. So I sometimes grab the photo so that sometimes they say, oh, you get in as well. I really don't want loads of like pictures of me going around. So I was like, no, I'll take a photo, you get in. So that's generally what happens now. And I don't mind taking pictures at all.
Talking about the red carpet, I mean, I genuinely can't imagine anything more scary than walking a red carpet. I'm so impressed that you've done that.
On the big ones, I'm never alone. I'm always with Chris. So that's, you know, when you've got someone to hold on to, you've got something to do with your hands. So that's always helpful.
If you fall over, someone's there to sort of laugh it off with.
Yeah. And also, I'm so bad at posing, but I don't not enjoy it because I love my vintage clothes so much. I don't have a stylist or anything like that. So when I'm on a red carpet, I'm wearing a dress that I've chosen that I'm really comfortable in, which really helps. And I really want to show off. So that's kind of fine. And generally, we don't go to an awful lot of things, especially this year, obviously. But generally, when we go to things, it's because Chris is nominated or in it. And it's always really fun.
Yeah, I guess that makes it really exciting.
But yeah, it's my husband's like night. So it's not, I'm not just on a red carpet for no reason. It's generally a reason. And so that for that reason,
that's true. Sort of looking at it at the abstract, it sounds really scary. But as you say, it's normally for something really exciting, in which case,
yeah,
it's kind of the whole event is really fun.
Exactly.
Dawn O'Porter, are you ready for this one? Because this is a hard one. It's the fourth desert island dish. What is your favourite sandwich?
Oh, I mean, that muffaletta I said earlier, but that's not something I can make because I wouldn't even try to recreate it. So my favourite sandwich, what a fantastic question. Oh my God, what avenue do I go down? I mean, I eat sandwiches most days.
I think I read that you're a fan of the Marmite and cream cheese sandwich.
I do love a Marmite. I give that to my kids a lot. Marmite and cream cheese, which is really good.
I don't think I've ever had that.
It's a really good combo. Mind you, if I'm having a sandwich for lunch, it's never going to be that. If I'm having a sandwich for lunch, salty butter, always mayonnaise, always Dijon, rocket, onion.
Raw onion.
Raw onion. Salt, pepper, always sea salt flakes. Very specific about salt. It would be whatever deli meat is in the fridge. Salami, serrano ham, maybe a few slices of cherry tomatoes. But I would put the cherry tomatoes into a bowl first and salt them and leave them for a minute.
Ooh, yes.
Because I just think that does something to them. So then I'll put them on top. What else would I whack in there? Lots more salty butter. And then I guess the ideal bread. I mean, nothing is better than a really soft but crunchy, soft in the middle crunchy baguette. Chris likes his sandwiches with toasted bread. I don't like that. I like soft, squishy bread. But just loads of mayonnaise. And that's like, I love mayonnaise more than I love my own children.
I love mayonnaise too. Let's start a club.
Yeah. The Ladies Mayonnaise Club.
Yes. I know that you enjoy crisps. What are your thoughts on crisps in sandwiches?
Oh, fantastic. I honestly would take crisps anyway and sideways, to be honest. Okay. I love crisps so much. I have crisps every single day. I don't have a sweet tooth at all. I honestly couldn't care less if every grain of sugar fell off the planet. I just have no interest in it. Occasionally, I might just think, I'll have some chocolate and then I'll have a bit. But a bar of chocolate could last in my house for 6 months if it was down to me.
Well, I feel like maybe that's a bit of a superpower, Dawn.
Maybe. See, Chris is the opposite. He's got such a sweet tooth, so actually it would last 5 minutes. But if it was on the desert island, if I had a bar of chocolate, I could make that last a long time. But fried potato is my downfall. And I love all of them. I love all of them.
All of them. All the crisps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about this year, because this is the year that prompted you to write Life in Pieces, which It's a sort of memoir, even though you say that you swore you'd never write a memoir, but it's a diary documenting life this year as you navigate grief, both personal but also collective. And you basically document the day-to-day reality of this year and a life that we just couldn't have predicted. Is that a good nutshell of the book?
It really is. I mean, I really, really had no idea that I was going to write a book this year because I started a blog. And after a few months, and the blog just ended up being, when we did that first stay-at-home order in March, for that 2 months, I basically just blogged every night because I was doing so much childcare, I couldn't write. So getting the kids to bed, pouring wine, eating crisps, and writing my blog became like this kind of therapeutic daily thing. And obviously after a few months, my publisher were like, can we publish this? This is quite good. And I said no initially because I put loads of stuff about the kids. I'm actually quite private about kids. And I put written about the kids way more than I ever would have. But my blog is subscription only. So people have to pay for it, which I do because that means I can be much more open because everyone wants to be there. It's not, I don't get, you know, bitchy comments. And I, so therefore I was.
Yeah, that's so nice.
Yeah. So therefore I was quite open about the kids. But for the book, I kind of, I took a lot of that stuff out because I didn't want it to go to a bigger audience. But it was very therapeutic to write about it at the time. But yeah, total accident. I said a lot. I really spoke. I was going through such a hard time. My friend Caroline Flack had obviously just died, and I was in such a mess emotionally, and then kind of thrust into this, you're not allowed out, you can't see your friends, you've only got to look after kids, and everyone outside your front door is dying of a deadly disease. It was like, okay, I've got something to write about.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. It's such a clever combination of, it's very, very moving, but it's also really funny, which it's so clever to be able to balance those two things.
Well, you do. I mean, even in the throes of like desperate grief in a global pandemic, like it's, some days were just funny.
Yeah.
And I'm so kind of proud of us as a family for finding joy despite, because I mean, Chris was really sad as well, but he was obviously also in the situation that everyone was in, but also dealing with a wife who was extremely sad.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how we managed to find moments of joy. We had moments of total non-joy and some really like horrible days where it just all got on top of us. But I'm really glad that I captured the fun bits too. I keep just thinking what a great thing it's going to be for the boys to read when they're older, because they won't really remember this year.
So fun. And I wanted to talk about the boys, because one of the things in the book, you say you developed a sort of excellent lockdown tradition of a 4 p.m. charcuterie board. And it did make me think, you have set the bar very high for your boys' future wives, haven't you?
Honestly, they are. I'm so determined that my kids will be the kind of boys who go to university and cook all their friends a Sunday lunch, and a really, really good one. I always got so turned on by boys who were really, really into food, and not just like, you know, burgers and chips, but really like into food, because I was. And so I just want the boys to be adventurous. I feel like food's taken me on such an adventure around the world. Like I've filmed and worked and traveled to all sorts of places. And it's just, I'm so glad that I love food, because that just extends your trip to this other level when you are willing to try things. And the idea that my kids are only 3 and 5 and Art is just starting to become adventurous. Like I can go to the fishmonger now and buy a huge crab and he'll come home and smash it up with me and eat it, which is amazing.
That's so exciting.
I know. And I've been so determined for them to not be kind of basic eaters. And even though Valentine is going through the stage of like not eating vegetables and being really annoying, I'm still like, I'm not going to just feed you like boring stuff. You're going to be foodies. You're going to be adventurous. We're going to go on holiday and you're going to try everything and we're going to do this. And so they're going to have to like end up with partners who are into food. Otherwise, they'll just be so disappointed.
But Ben, they're going to be very disappointed if their wife isn't whipping up a charcuterie board at 4 p.m.
I know. I'm going to be that kind of mother-in-law, though, who like sends them a daily menu.
Oh, yeah.
And says, you have to provide this for the boys today. And if you don't, it will arrive in hamper form on your doorstep.
I love it. Okay, let's talk about the fifth desert island dish. And that's a dish you eat the most often.
It's got to be an egg on toast. I have it every morning.
Oh, you do?
I do. I have a fried egg on toast almost every morning. I just, and some mornings I think I should have something different because That would be good, but I just love it. Really salty.
No, if it isn't broken, don't fix it.
Yeah, so I just nearly did an egg breaking joke there that would have been absolutely terrible.
We love them on Desert Island Dishes, Dawn.
Okay, well, the egg is broken. So I do a fried egg on toast, on buttery wholemeal toast, and maybe every second to third morning, I will also smash an avocado onto that toast and put, oh my God, my big discovery in lockdown, which I didn't really know about before because I always thought it was fake food, but it isn't. It's
what?
Garlic powder.
Oh, yes.
Garlic powder is an absolute revelation. It's not minced garlic, like fake lazy garlic, which is what I always thought it was. It's so delicious. So buttery toast with smash the avocado and put loads of garlic powder in it, a few chili flakes, and a little bit of cumin and a squeeze of lemon.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, that smashed up under a fried egg. Oh, God.
But I think you're right about garlic powder. I think it's particularly big in America, but it's definitely really underrated, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really good. I get through it, loads of it. What it's really good for is if I make the boys a pizza, I use that tomato sauce, the passata that we were talking about before, and just put garlic powder and a little bit of oregano. It's just the most perfect, easy pizza tomato base.
That's a good tip.
Yeah, it's really good for the kids because it makes choice. So if you do lamb chops or something like that, and you don't want to overwhelm them with herbs, kids can be a bit weird about herbs. But if you just sprinkle the garlic powder on the lamb chops or onto steak or whatever it is, or chicken, then they're getting quite a strong flavour. So they're not getting bland food, which is my fear with kids, is that they get used to bland food, so they don't ever want to try anything else. But it's really useful. I love it. So yeah, fried egg on toast, possibly with avocado, is my most munched meal.
That should have been the question, shouldn't it? What is your most munched meal? You talk about corned beef and cabbage quite a lot in the book, and I don't think I've ever had it.
So it's obviously very Irish. They sell it out here around St. Patrick's Day in packets. It's like in a vacuumed plastic pack, a huge...
So it's beef brisket, isn't it?
Yes, but I don't know what the process of corning beef is. I should look into it, but...
I think it's pickled.
Yeah, it's absolutely delicious. So you buy it in the packet and it's got all the pickling spices in with it. And then you literally just boil it for 3 hours. And it's tender and absolutely delicious. And then for the last, say, 45 minutes of boiling it, you just quarter a cabbage and chuck that in the water. And so when it's done, you take out the beef and just slice it like a normal beef joint and then stick a big kind of sloppy quarter of cabbage on the side and serve that with mashed potato. And you've just got this kind of really easy, salty, gorgeous. And whenever I cook it for people, they're so impressed. But it's honestly the easiest thing that I cook. It's all just boiled.
Ooh, that does sound really good. I was doing some reading because I'm a nerd, and it's actually not a national dish of Ireland, but it's a national dish of the Irish in America. Did you know that?
I think that's because I think it's got something to do with the large Jewish community here anyway, because I knew the answer to this. There's something where so boiled bacon and cabbage is the traditional Irish dish, but Jewish people don't eat bacon. So they do corned beef here instead. I think that's something that I heard or read as to why corned beef was so popular here, as opposed to, yes, but in Ireland, it would be bacon and cabbage.
Ah, okay, that's interesting. Did this year make you think about food differently? Because there were obviously times when it was hard to know if you were going to be able to buy food and the supermarkets were empty and there was sort of rationing going on. I know that you compiled a list of essentials to sort of keep in your basement, but did this year change the way that you cook or think about food?
Well, it did it was my therapy. I love my kids. I wouldn't say I'm one of those mums who wants to be with them this much.
Yeah.
So I found cooking was my real grown-up activity. We decided right at the start that I was going to do all the food. It was just easier. I would do all the food orders. I would do all the cooking. I know it was in the fridge. I'd plan the meals and that was it. So I'm really glad we did that because it's my hobby and I love it. And what lockdown did is it made me realize, well, so I know we're going to talk about cookery books later, but I had Jamie Oliver's Five Ingredients book, and books like that made me, and what lockdown did, made me very good at making meals out of fewer ingredients because you couldn't rely on the fact that you were going to get them. So, you know, for me, it was a case of good quality, if I could get it, meat, and doing very little with it. And I don't know. I mean, here's the thing about this year. I'm in a really fortunate position where I was able to go to the supermarket and buy food. You know, I feel like for me, food was a real indulgence this year. It was a real pleasure. That makes me very, very, very lucky that I was able to do that, that not only were we in a position to get the food, we were queuing up in car parks waiting for, you know, food packages to feed our families, which a lot of people were, but I was in a position where I was cooking for a family of four and enjoyed it. That wasn't awful to me. I've got some friends who were just found that whose husbands don't like either. And so it just fell on my girlfriends to do breakfast, lunch and dinner, feed everybody for all that time. They hate cooking. They found it really, really hard. And it was the worst thing about lockdown for them. So I feel very lucky.
Yeah. I think it was the sort of the relentlessness of cooking three meals a day was what really ground quite a lot of people down, wasn't it?
Yes. But for me, see, that was like
heaven.
Heaven. And then once a week. So we'd get a takeout once a week on like Thursday nights, we were ordering, and that was really nice to get a night off. And if I ever wanted to and say to Chris, will you cook? He would. But I generally find myself around 5 o'clock kind of, what should I do tonight? And being quite excited at the prospect of doing it.
What's your go-to takeaway?
Oh, I mean, there's lots of tacos here because of the Mexican influence. We've got a really good taco place around the corner. So fish tacos. But my favourite takeaway would definitely be a Thai green curry.
Ooh, yes.
Because I don't make it. I tried to cook it once. It was a disaster. So I'm like, I'm not even going to try and perfect that. That's just going to be my takeout dish.
There's no point ordering something that you can easily make yourself.
No, exactly.
Okay, let's move on to the sixth desert island dish. And it's, what is your go-to dinner party dish? And obviously, no one's having dinner parties at the moment. But sort of in the future, when happier times are around the corner and you have your friends round, what is it that you're going to be cooking?
Well, one thing that I cooked a few months ago that I was really impressed with and I wanted to do it for ages was beef Wellington.
Mm.
And I have been really intimidated by the idea of doing a beef Wellington for so long. And actually, if you watch Gordon Ramsay's video on him doing his Christmas one, it's a bit time consuming, a bit fiddly, but it's not hard at all. It's actually very simple, very few ingredients. And it looked absolutely beautiful and it tasted absolutely beautiful. The only challenge I've got is Chris doesn't really like rare meat.
Oh no.
So I've got to, yeah, so I want to make it again, but work out how to kind of cook the beef a little longer without burning the pastry. So these are my challenges in life right now.
That's the only hard thing about a Wellington, is it's easy to put together, but it's just the cooking because you can't see what's happening to the beef inside.
Exactly. But generally, if people don't mind rare meat, because it's a really nice cut of meat in there because it's the fillet. So if people don't mind rare meat, then it doesn't matter really what's going on inside. But if you've got someone who doesn't really want it like really, really pink. But the other really, really easy dinner party dish that I do often when I've just got people coming over is Jamie Oliver's sausage and cherry tomato bake. That is just a one tray bake with like sausages and cherry tomatoes and vinegar, and it's so easy and so delicious. That with mashed potato and salad, and people would just be jizzing all over the place. Sorry.
Dawn, there's a brilliant podcast out there. I don't know if you've ever heard it, but it's called How I Built This. And the host asks every single guest the same question. And I wanted to pose it to you because of something that I read. So the question is, how much of your success is down to luck and timing, and how much is down to you and your hard work?
Wow. Then you may have read that I slightly resent the concept of luck when it comes to my work.
Yes.
Because when people say, oh, you're so lucky to have written 7 books, I'm like, what? I don't feel lucky. Like that's a lot of hard work. That is putting yourself out there. That is locking yourself away. That is, I don't feel lucky when it comes to my career necessarily. I lucked out when I married Chris, who was really well known and probably elevated my position a lot more. So a lot more people hear about my books. That's very lucky. But then also, are you lucky for your choice of husband? Like, this is my husband. I'm not lucky. I met him. I fell in love with him. I work at my marriage. So the idea of luck is just very, it's very difficult. The only thing I really feel lucky for right now is that I'm healthy and I have 2 healthy children. Everything else, all my relationships, all of my success, all of that is down to good choices and working hard and coping with failure. And yeah, that. But I see luck as the one thing we can't really do anything about is the deal we get, you know, in terms of our health. And so yeah, I feel lucky to be healthy.
No, I think that's a good answer. It's sort of the idea of introducing luck is sort of belittling the hard work that you've put in. And I think with your particular career, that kind of applies more. I think other when this host asks this question on the podcast, there's sort of big moments in people's lives where they could have got a no to this, you know, business idea and everything would have been different, but instead doors opened and, you know, the rest is history. But I completely understand what you're saying.
Well, I say, for example, you wouldn't look at someone like Oprah. I don't look at Oprah and say she's lucky. I say that woman has grafted and, you know, lived through the ups and downs. And that's not luck. That's hard work.
Yeah. And also, I don't know, not to sort of, you know, bang this drum all the time, but maybe it's something we say more about women. I'm not sure we often say a really successful man. We don't really look at him and say, oh, he's so lucky that he got there.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's very true.
On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. So what is your most treasured cookbook?
Quick answer is anything Jamie Oliver ever writes, I am here for. I think he's absolutely unbelievable. But the book that I chose for this, some of the best cookbooks around are not by well-known successful chefs. They are people who managed to get a book deal for some reason and just have put down all their family recipes. And sometimes you can discover absolute belters of cookbooks that way. And this one, it's called Social Kitchen and it's by a lady called Shali Tucker. I went to an event and it was quite a small catered event and she had done all of the food and the food was absolutely delicious and it felt really like proper home cooking. So I got talking to her, went to see her in the kitchen. And she told me all about herself and how her mum, she'd lost her mum, but she had created a cookbook of all her mum's old fantastic recipes.
Wow.
And I love, love, love this cookbook. There's kind of a Jewish influence in it. And it's just, but there's proper, proper, proper food. There's one in it called a pot roast chicken, which is essentially, she does it in the oven, but I boil a chicken on the hob. And it's one of my favorite dishes that I do. And I would never have thought to boil a chicken on the hob unless it was from this book. And she's also just got really good, like, she's got a dish which is just jarred peppers that she boils in vinegar and sugar for about 3 hours and then just spreads over whipped cream cheese. It's the most amazing dip, but really easy and really family friendly, dinner party friendly, and really like onion rings and stuff like that. I absolutely love it. Social Kitchen by Shali Tucker. It's one of those books where, I mean, I've got no idea how successful this book is, but she's not well known. So I've got no idea. You never hear anyone talking about it, but it's an absolute gem.
And you're so right. That's such a nice premise for a book. I feel like we're in a world that's kind of obsessed by celebrity, but actually everyone's family has delicious recipes that sort of deserve to be written down and remembered, don't they?
Yes. Oh my God, so much. I mean, I just think Jamie Oliver's a genius and he's taught me how to cook. His books have really taught me how to cook. But I just love it when people take the time to write down, like, you know, mum and granny's old recipes, because they're always, the reason they become family favourites is because everyone loves them.
Yeah, that's such a nice choice. Thank you, Dawn. Right, we're on to the seventh and final desert island dish, and that is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. You're allowed several courses. I don't know if I said that.
Okay, so I mean, to start, I'd probably go for something like Chelon jumbo prawns in garlic butter with white crusty buttery bread. For my main course, oh God, I mean, a dish that I cook all the time that I just absolutely love, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall's lamb chops in capers and thyme.
Ooh.
It's greasy and the lamb is tender and it's capers, which I love. I'd have that with buttery mashed potato and maybe some arugula salad. And that's rocket for those who don't know what I'm talking about. And then I'd skip puddings, don't care, and then just have like a massive cheese plate.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Oh,
yeah.
Dawn, thank you so much for letting us hear your desert island dishes.
I mean, honestly, just talking about food is such a joy. It's just such a lovely hour.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So there we have it, another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. Don't forget that you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and it really does make a difference. I know it's a cliche, but it boosts the show in the charts and helps others to find it, which is great, and also means I can keep bringing it to you each week. If you don't already, come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes. It's changed from Margie Namora. And you can sign up for the newsletter and find a whole host of different recipes at desertislanddishes.co. And I will see you next week. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you to our sponsor, Kalinko.
brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.